Today, I have a guest with me. I have my young son who said, "Hey, I'll come and hang out with you. Do you want to say hello, son?"
Hello. Hi, everyone.
Hey, everyone. Hey, look, you're hearing my son. Hey, son, why don't you tell who's the greatest dad who's ever existed? Who is that?
You.
There you go. There you go. This was not at all planned. He was not answering this under any duress. He's answering truthfully. All right. He may later ask me a question. He just wants to hang out to see how these things are done. Maybe one day he will become a even bigger professor and even more famous. Who knows? Maybe. But any good parent only wishes for their children to surpass them. Otherwise, they're malignant narcissists. So there you go. Okay, so today what I want to talk about, last week I did a things that are pissing me off, and at the time, I've now posted it also on my YouTube channel and posted it on my podcast, but it's also still available on, you know, on X. If you go to the highlights, you could see it's still there, the recording is up. I talked about three things that pissed me off last week, in case you had missed it. This whole idea of misinformation versus disinformation and how there should be a czar, a governmental czar that tells us what is right and what is wrong and what is veridical and what is not, and what I think of such idiocy. Then I talked about the game 6 Degrees of Jew, whereby the Moscow attack in this case was, you know, really the Mossad and the Jews who did it. And then number three that pissed me off is the they're Ebola, basically. The three late-night hosts, Jimmy Fallon, Jimmy Kimmel, and Stephen Colbert, and just how painfully unfunny they are. And then number four, I talked about the upcoming election between Trump and Biden and things that are pissing me off there. And again, I remind you that I'm Canadian, so I don't have a dog in that fight. And so if I weigh in, it's because I'm doing so from 30,000 feet up. I really, as I said, I have no bones to pick with either parties. I just call it as I see it. Today, what I wanted to talk about, things that are pissing me off. Well, obviously, it's something that's been pissing me off for 30 years because I've been a professor for 30 years. Actually, this June, I will be celebrating my 30th year. As a matter of fact, June 21st, 1994, so in a few months, it'll be 30 years that I defended my doctoral dissertation at Cornell. And so, of course, I saw all kinds of craziness in academia, which, of course, I've been warning about for decades, resulting in my writing The Parasitic Mind. But, of course, the mind viruses that I thought I had offered a vaccine for have not been completely eradicated. We're not yet at the level of polio eradication or smallpox eradication. So we still need to do a lot of work. So today I want to talk about things that are pissing me off in academia with a bit of a twist. The idea of sort of this orgiastic calculus of niceness, right? I'm okay, you're okay, how are your feelings? Let's all be nice, let's all be kind, let's all be tolerant, let's all be compassionate. Which, of course, in no way am I arguing that people should not be kind as a default value. In no way am I arguing that people should be, mean as a way of being. But when it comes to academia, the fundamental thing that you're trying to optimize, as I explain in The Parasitic Mind, is the pursuit of truth, the discovery of knowledge, the dissemination of knowledge. To the extent that some of that might hurt someone's feelings, so be it, okay? So let me first begin, because I want to first begin with some of this weakness that I'm seeing in academia. So I'll give you an example. So first I'll talk about some of the weakness in terms of how we're training students, and then I'll discuss it in a broader sense. So, as you probably know, any university has an office of disabilities that you know, if students have real disabilities, of course, they should be accommodated, and that's perfectly fine. And that makes perfect sense. Now, it turns out very much like how until 15 minutes ago, you know, there had been one out of 10,000 people who were transgender, and suddenly there was a social contagion. By the way, the person who published a paper in Plus One from Brown University, if you remember, she got into a lot. She's a pediatrician, I think, by training, if I'm not mistaken. And she got into a lot of trouble because she argued that the transgender craze was a social contagion. That doesn't mean that transgender people don't exist. That doesn't mean that transgender people don't have a right to live free of bigotry. But when you go from one out of 10,000 people who are transgender to every second person in my kid's classroom is transgender, then we've got a problem, Houston. It's a bunch of bullshit. Okay. And so the Office of Disability, my first 20 some years as a professor, I almost had no student who registered with the Office of Disability, right? Which made sense because it should be a very small number. And then over the past 4 or 5 years, probably around 10% of my students have special accommodations under the Office of Disabilities. So something happened in the last 5, 6 years whereby everyone is now disabled. That's the default value. So for example, I suffer from exam anxiety. Therefore, I am disabled. Therefore, I need 17 times more time than someone who doesn't have exam anxiety. Oh, exam anxiety? It's called life. Everyone who goes into an exam, I studied in university for 10 years. I knew my stuff. I was a top student. I got butterflies before some exams because you're worried. Am I going to do well? Am I not going to do well? But you overcome it. But now, for example, when we went back after COVID finished and we went back to our first departmental meeting and, you know, we were going around the faculty, here are some of the things that professors were saying. Well, the students since COVID are simply too stressed to be able to sit through an entire lecture. You see that? So some of us went through the Lebanese Civil War where we didn't know every second of every day whether this was going to be our last. And other students have an equal difficulty, which is they simply can't sit still because COVID. So let's find a way to accommodate them by maybe lecturing less, or maybe we should do jumping jacks while lecturing. That way they can, you know, they could be entertained. Then we also had students who had lost the ability to take notes. So they had taking notes anxiety. So we had to, you know, maybe accommodate that. Then there was, you know, taking exam anxiety and so on and so forth. And instead of saying, hey, toughen up a bit, it's part of life. No, it's try to find ways to coddle, to nurture, to love and be kindful. So what I want to do is read you a long section. This is from it starts on page 154 of my latest book, the book on happiness. So I have a chapter where I talk about resilience and the anti-fragility to failure. You have to be anti-fragile when it comes to failure, right? I mean, most of the successful people that you know have at some point failed, right? And them being champion is the fact that they overcome the failures and then they end up coming on top. And so I have a section titled Baptism by Fire as a Form of Anti-Fragility. And it's very relevant to our conversation here because bear with me, it's going to be a while. I'm going to read it. Maybe it'll take about 5-10 minutes. But towards the end, I recount a story that happened to me when I was a doctoral student at Cornell and how my professors treated me. And by today's standards, I should be filing, you know, an abuse case against them because they were so mean and tough to me. All right, so here we go. So I'm reading now verbatim till the end of this section. So this is from page 154 of The Sad Truth About Happiness, which I truly hope that you'd get it. It really is a very uplifting, positive, fun book. It's a combination of ancient wisdoms regarding good life, coupled, backed up with contemporary science, and then backed up, or if you like, peppered with my personal stories, my personal trajectory of happiness. So it's a really, really fun book. Let me ask my son how I'm doing so far. How am I doing, son? Great. Are you bored or are you having fun?
I'm having fun.
Yeah, he seems he's got that sort of preteen You're boring, Dad. Am I getting that? What's happening with my son? All right, let's go. Most worthy endeavors in life, be it completing medical school, running a marathon, or starting a new business, require persistence and focus. The late basketball great Kobe Bryant coined the term Mamba mentality, which he explained as follows. Hard work outweighs talent every time. Mamba mentality is about 4 a.m. workouts, doing more than the next guy, and then trusting in the work you've put in when it's time to perform. Without studying, preparation, and practice, you're leaving the outcome to fate. I don't do fate, close quote. So that's Kobe Bryant with his Mamba mentality. Let's go on. Psychologist Angela Lee Duckworth has pioneered the study of the grit trait, which captures this form of stick-to-itiveness. While grit is correlated with various achievement outcomes, such as academic performance, it has a more general positive effect on happiness and well-being, and this holds true across wildly disparate cultures. Part of possessing grit is the capacity to be resilient in overcoming obstacles as you seek to achieve your goals. While resilience is in part shaped by an individual's personality, some forms of childhood adversity foster resilience, which may result in beneficial outcomes. In the same way that one's immune system needs to be challenged during childhood for optimal functioning, overcoming psychological stressors is a key feature of peak functioning. You cannot lead a maximally enriching life if you are never challenged. Developing a proper response to life stressors is a central feature of resilience. I have experienced some of the worst imaginable childhood adversity growing up during the Lebanese Civil War, but those negative experiences have allowed me to develop great resilience in tackling the more mundane challenges of my life in Canada and the United States. Let's keep going. Rigorous training in specific skills and in how to respond to challenging situations under stress is part of many jobs, especially in the military. Pilots go through demanding flight training. Those who want to be Army Rangers or Navy SEALs are compelled to push their minds and bodies to the limit. But there are other occupations and professions that metaphorically have grown flabby and weak. That would include, I'm afraid, higher education and my academic colleagues, all those tepid hyper-specialists who are too afraid to utter one word that might offend academic superiors, militant feminists, the pronoun Taliban, or the woke mafia. Knowledge be damned. In the last few years, I have noticed that this weak mindset permeates all layers of academia, but especially when interviewing prospective hires for assistant professorships. When I was a doctoral student at Cornell University, young academics had their first big baptism by fire moment when they were invited as part of a departmental speaker series to give a lecture from their developing doctoral dissertation. This was a very intimidating platform from which to share one's research because the audience did not suffer fools gladly, and professors prepared senior doctoral students for the eventual grilling they would face when seeking assistant professorships at elite universities. I faced additional anti-fragility obstacles as I made my way through my PhD. Doctoral students at the Johnson Graduate School of Management at Cornell had to pass the A exam, which was made up of two parts. One, professors serving on a student's PhD dissertation committee could ask questions about his specific area of expertise. While many doctoral students had a supervisor and two additional committee members, my doctoral committee was composed of four outstanding scholars, Drs. J. Edward Russo, who's a cognitive psychologist, Douglas Stamen, who's a advertising researcher, Ali Hadi, who's a world-renowned statistician, and Alberto Segre, who is a computer scientist. So, number two, once the doctoral student presented his dissertation proposal, the committee members would ask pointed questions about the prospective research. No question was out of bounds, as the student had to demonstrate complete mastery of his subject and his proposed dissertation research. As I presented my dissertation proposal on that fateful day, I noticed that my committee members were not exuding an aura of friendliness. The tone was set by my doctoral supervisor, who began the barrage of tough questions. As I fielded his first question, he took an indignant deep breath and retorted, quote, "I'm going to ask the question a second time, hoping that maybe this time you'll understand it," close quote. And we're off. When it came time for Professor Hari, a world-renowned statistician, to ask his questions, he started off by saying, "I know that I told you that I would not ask you detailed technical statistical questions. Well, I lied," close quote. He then proceeded to ask me a very detailed technical question, which, because I was well prepared, I managed to answer. Once the professors had gone through several rounds of very probing and difficult questions, I was asked to step outside the room as they deliberated my fate. I asked my supervisor, "Should I stand by the door outside the room?" He stared at me coldly and responded, "Stand far enough that you cannot hear us." As I stood outside the room, I felt somewhat frazzled. I thought I had answered all the questions properly, and I certainly knew my material, but based on the harsh tone of some of the questions, I felt quite nervous. After what seemed like an interminable wait, the door swung wide open, and my doctoral supervisor walked toward me with a full smile. I was puzzled and a little unhappy and asked him what was going on. So he answers, quote, "Oh, this was some good old-fashioned Ivy League butt-kicking," he said. "It will make a man out of you. We are trying to make sure that you can handle yourself when you go out on the campus visits," close quote. As I made my way back into the examination room, the other committee members were all smiling and congratulatory. The tense environment had dissipated into the usual warmth of their supportive mentorship. Let me just go on. I'm almost done. Two more paragraphs. Once doctoral students defend their dissertation proposals, they send application packets to universities hoping to land a job. The first round of interviews is usually held at the annual academic conference of their discipline. In my case, as previously mentioned, I had around 25 scheduled interviews. The interviewers require that one present one's dissertation work in a cogent and succinct manner. In preparation for that eventuality, my doctoral supervisor had me prepare a one-page summary of my dissertation, which I excitedly agreed to do. He had me rewrite it several times, and in one instance, he feigned falling asleep before telling me, quote, "Now go back and rewrite this so I don't fall asleep reading the first sentence," close quote. Throughout this process, I became deeply indebted to my great mentors for testing my resilience and mental toughness. They did not coddle me. They were not concerned with sparing my feelings. They did not give me a participation trophy for showing up. They expected great things of me, and accordingly, they made sure to test my anti-fragility. For that, I am eternally grateful to them. Incidentally, I recently found out that my doctoral supervisor is retiring from Cornell. He has since retired. Several of his former doctoral students, including yours truly, joined him for a commemorative get-together. Expressing gratitude is not only polite, but also another component of a good and happy life. And by the way, I'm going next week back to Cornell, where I'll be giving two talks at my alma mater. And I think my former doctoral supervisor and several of my former professors will be there. So it'd be great. Now, why do I tell that story? Because I'm contextualizing the kind of training I had at my PhD, incredibly rigorous and, you know, hardcore PhD at Cornell, with some of the stuff that I see today with students, where, you know, I've had administrator call me asking, you know, why my grades in my graduate course were the way they were. Because, you know, it's expected that everybody receives an A. Well, no. There is this little thing called a bell curve. The bell curve means some people do extremely well, most people are in the middle, and some people do poorly. That's why it's called the bell curve, the normal distribution. So again, by the way, in The Parasitic Mind, I talk about how 30, 40 years ago, the average grade in university was a C, as you would expect it. in many universities today, the average grade is an A. Think about it for a second. Let me repeat. This is, by the way, a Duke professor who did that analysis. The average grade is an A. What does that mean then? Nothing. Incredible scamming of grade inflation, but at least you're being kind. You're being empathetic. You're being compassionate. You're being sweet. You're being loving. You're not being mean like Professor Saad and his former mentors. All right. So now, having said that, I'm done with reading from the Sad Truth About Happiness. So I wanted to now talk a bit about some of the cowardice. As I mentioned in the alert regarding this X spaces, I said that zoologists have discovered a new species. It's called Academicus invertebrus castrati, which means what? Academics are largely invertebrates, and they're castrated, right? You know the expression, grow a spine. You know the expression, grow a pair. It means what? Have dignity, have fortitude, defend the truth, say things that might be hurtful to someone. That's what an intellectual should do, right? I've talked about cowardice as the eighth deadly sin, right? You all have heard the seven deadly sin, the cardinal sins, of which, by the way, pride is the suprasin, because pride, in this sense, meaning self-love, is the sin from which all other sins flow out of. Well, I have always argued that there should be an eighth sin called cowardice. Now, some people might argue that cowardice can fit within sloth, being a sloth, or in the old term was avarice. But in any case, cowardice is why we are where we are in the West, right? Until 15 minutes ago, history was defined as follows. There is one tribe called A. There is a river separating that tribe from tribe B. Tribe B has its sight on some resources that tribe A has, and vice versa. They either peacefully coexist, not infringing on each other, or at some point, one of the two tribes says, hey, I think I'd like to have access to your water, to your animal protein, to your beautiful women. Let's go to war. And then we fight. But the understanding is that the members of both tribes are willing to fight to protect what's theirs. Yes? That's called history. Every single thing in history is defined by that universal law. The West has decided that it no longer abides by that historical and evolutionary imperative. It's basically said, no, we open the door to you, you do what you want to us, you destroy our society, you do anything to any of us, and that demonstrates that we are virtuous, that we are compassionate, that we are tolerant, that we are kind, that we are empathetic, right? And that orgiastic faux empathy trickles down to academia, where the key way to act as an academic, by the way, it's not as though I go to academic settings and I start swearing and getting drunk and throwing up all over the place. I'm very professorial. I speak with probably a lexicon that is more than 10 professors combined. So it's not as though I can't be professorial, but that also doesn't mean that I always play nice when it comes to speaking the truth. But it turns out, for example, that at my university, that's very frowned upon because there are complaints that are consistently lodged against me because, you know, I say very dangerous and mean things like men can't menstruate. That makes me transphobic. I might say things like, well, maybe Islam might be more prone to violence than, say, Jainism. The Jains, when they're walking, they're such pacifists that they walk with a broom sweeping the floor because lest they might step on an ant inadvertently. So the tenets of their religion, the Jains, is such that you can genuinely say that the canonical content of their religion is one of pacifism. Now, if I say, well, Islam is not quite so, and here is 1400 years of data that supports that, as I explain in chapter 7 of The Parasitic Mind, well, then there are complaints filed against me at my university, and I am so mean and bigoted. If I say that when it comes to human beings, Charles Darwin was right in saying that sexual selection presumes that there are two phenotypes called male and female, well, that's very mean. That's very anti-scientific of me, because we now know that there are 873 genders and maybe 376 biological sexes, right? So therefore, why don't you shut your mouth, Gadsad, and just play nice? And I explained to people at my university that I don't go out of my way to be mean to anybody. I'm actually very measured in my tone. What I do is never modulate the positions I take in the pursuit of sparing someone's feelings. My main job as an intellectual, as a professor, is to create knowledge, disseminate knowledge, and defend the truth. That's why my message has resonated with millions of people. So it pisses me off to no end that I can be getting chastised by people, by academics, because, you know, why can't you just play nice? By the way, several years ago, and my son is sitting here with me because he was with me, we were walking and we were accosted by a person who threatened me in front of my son. When I went to the police to report the case, you know what the police said to me? Well, maybe you shouldn't be speaking on these difficult subjects, and then you wouldn't get threatened, which, by the way, that's what I was told at my university. Imagine how devastatingly chilling that is. And I analogized it as follows. Recently, in a conversation with an administrator, we would all be very angry if a judge said to a woman who had been raped, hey, maybe you should consider not wearing such sexy clothes, and then you wouldn't get the attention of men. We would find that repulsive, correctly so, yes? That would be called victim blaming. But imagine now if I speak out, for example, I spoke out about the horrors of the Hamas attack because, you know, I have tons of family in Israel. That triggered a lot of complaints against me at Concordia, because it doesn't make sense for the Jewish guy who escaped the Middle East, who has tons of family in Israel, which he has to call to make sure they weren't killed and raped, for him to be upset about what happened on October 7th. That's simply too Islamophobic. I should only be concerned about what the IDF is doing to the noble, peaceful Palestinians. That's not the kind of world we want to be living in, right? You want to criticize Judaism? Go at it. All you want. You want to say that circumcision is a bunch of crock and that Judaism prescribes this and it's nonsense? Go for it. It's called a free country. You want to deny the Holocaust, which is the most insulting thing in the world? Go for it. The only thing you can't do is engage in direct incitement to violence. So why is it that I can withstand the fact that people could attack me in endless ways, but apparently I have to field 1,000 different complaints because boo-hoo-hoo, I demonstrated. Oh, by the way, here's another one that led to a lot of complaints against me. I shared a histogram from the Nobel Foundation, the Nobel Prize Foundation. So this is, I took a screenshot from the Nobel Foundation that was showing the breakdown of who's won Nobel Prizes, you know, men versus women, different countries, and so on. One of the figures was Jews make up 0.2% of the world, and they have won a quarter of Nobel Prizes. And that was contrasted to the noble faith, where they constitute about 1/4 of humanity, and they've won 4 Nobel Prizes. So the fact that I shared the histogram as posted by the Nobel Foundation That was a complaint against me. My university didn't say, we stand unequivocally with Professor Saad. We are proud of what Professor Saad does. It's more, why are you such a troublemaker? That's not what you want from academia. Okay, that's, and by the way, I'm only speaking about my university because that's where I work, but believe me, this is happening at every single university. And of course, most colleagues don't have my personality, don't have my personhood. Therefore, they say, yeah, okay, I'll keep quiet. Of course, they'll write me letters saying, oh my God, I wish I could speak. I can't take it. I'm leaving academia. I just finished my PhD. I'm not going to go into academia. But then I get the administrators telling me, hey, can you just be quiet and stop this stuff? Not you're a hero. That's not what they're saying. So now let me mention a few other little stories. There was a Harvard professor who reached out to me, or his publicist reached out to me. He's a Turing Award winner. Alan Turing is one of the most brilliant mathematicians you could ever come across. As you know, I studied mathematics and computer science. I took a course in formal languages where we learned about Turing machines and formal languages. It's mind-blowing. It's almost impossible to imagine that a human mind can think at such a level. It almost borders on the religious, how brilliant he is. Well, Turing, by the way, faced incredible homophobia in Britain in the last century, in the 40s. In any case, the Turing Award is granted, is akin to winning the Nobel Prize. It's granted in, you know, applied mathematics, computer science, and so on. So the gentleman who was coming on my show, who asked to come on my show because he had a book coming out, is a Turing Award winner who's a senior tenured professor at Harvard. So if you were concerned, oh, but you know, some professors don't speak because they don't have tenure and so on, which by the way, should never be a reason, because it's better to live as a dignified person for 1 minute than to live as a coward for 500 years. Okay, have dignity. Okay, but in any case, this professor is a tenured full professor. He's a senior professor. He's a Turing Award winner. His agent writes to me, he'd love to come on your show to discuss the book. I was like excited. Oh, great. Please send me a copy of the book. I'll read the book and let's do it. So we went back and forth many, many times. It was hard to organize it. Finally, we did. Then I got another email. Well, the professor in question, by the way, until recently, I hadn't mentioned who he was, and many people wrote to me, even pretty high-profile people, saying, well, you should name the person because, you know, it's if they're doing this, they should be held accountable. I'm going to refrain from naming them, just like I didn't mention who the administrators were and so on. Maybe one day I will mention it, but it's a senior professor at Harvard in computer science who's a Turing Award winner. Let's leave it at that. So I got an email saying, well, he wants to make sure that you don't discuss anything political and that you only focus on his book. I said, oh, no problem. Absolutely. I understand. You know, I've had hundreds of conversations with other academics on my show. No problem. And by the way, I told the person, I have a computer science and math background. There's all kinds of really cool stuff that I can talk to him about. No problem. We'll focus on the book. Okay, great. So now we go back and forth a few more times. So I probably wasted between me and my assistant who helps me with the scheduling, probably wasted about 4 hours in total of going back and forth and so on and so forth. Finally, I get an email. Well, I'm very sorry to tell you that Professor so-and-so has decided he doesn't want to come on your show because, you know, it's boo-hoo. God, he's mean, he's dangerous. God, he's so scary. He's so scary. God is so scary. He does things like defend freedom of speech. He does things like defend the rights of gay people to live in dignity in the Middle East. He defends the right of women to have clitorises. I hope my son didn't hear that. You know, he defends these really controversial things. He defends things like freedom of speech, freedom of inquiry, very dangerous things. He says that there is no such thing as indigenous science. There's only science. Very, very dangerous things, right? So dangerous that he's invited to speak at Stanford. So dangerous that he's going to give two talks at Cornell. But boo-hoo-hoo, I'm so controversial at my university. Why don't I just shut up? Okay. No, I'm not going to shut up because I escaped the society where I had to shut up. So I come to Canada and I'm warning people, don't let happen here from which many of us immigrants escaped. It will creep up on you faster than you can say, boo-hoo, I'm scared of Gatsad. Okay, so number one, that's an example of what an invertebrate castrati is. By the way, I wrote to him, oh boy, you don't want to have been the recipient of that email. Let me tell you, he got third degree burn with that one. And by the way, it's very polite, it's very professorial, but there's no mincing of words. It's direct, it's to the point. Let me tell you another quick story. 2016, I was very close to being hired for the third time at a university in Southern California. And again, I'm being way too sweet here by not mentioning the name of the university, which, by the way, I should name and shame. And that and by the way, as you know, I love Southern California. I've been meaning to move my family to Southern California. I was a professor at UC Irvine for a few years. We have family there. We go back every year. It truly is our home, away from home. And so I was very excited for this position. And as I met one of the senior people in this one particular department that was interested in me, we went for lunch at this very beautiful place in Newport Beach. And then she said, well, I have a concern, Gad. I'm like, oh, what is it? She goes, well, I was going through your YouTube channel. This, by the way, is, I tracked it for you. It's The Sad Truth, number 233. I released it on August 4th, 2016. So this is almost 8 years ago. She said, well, so I was looking at your clip, and I'm very concerned by that clip. Now, let me tell you about the clip in question. My family and I, my wife, my children and I, they were much younger, 8 years ago, were sitting in this beautiful area called the Balboa Peninsula, which is an area in Newport Beach, close to where we used to live and where we go every summer. It's a beautiful, pristine beach. This is an area where, for those of you who are from the area, you know there's the Wedge, which is an area where you have these huge waves that can crash. It's actually quite intimidating to swim there. You really need to know what you're doing. There are rip currents and so on. So it's a beautiful, pristine beach. This woman is sitting there with those plastic containers that have, let's say, 8 muffins, cupcakes, right? So it's like these multicolored cupcakes. She's sitting there and she's eating them. She eats a few of them, leaves the rest, leaves the massive plastic container, and all of the remaining cupcakes, which now the birds are going to come and they're going to get instantaneous diabetes since it's all sugar. And so I say to her, I'm not the one who says, please don't use the internet and use homing pigeons because, Mother Earth, please. I am green conscious in that I've taught my children very young, let's walk around the beach, let's clean the beach, let's make sure we leave the beach better than we, leave it off better than when we came. So I do things like that. And so I turned to the lady and I said, excuse me, ma'am, can you think you could maybe just pick up, the massive plastic container containing 43 tons of cupcakes? And by the way, as she's walking off from the beach, there are tons of garbage containers. So it's not as though she has to trek through the Sahara to get to the garbage can if she were, sufficiently lazy that she didn't want to do it. So she looks at me and very aggressively, like, mind your own business, asshole. And then, calls me some fat name because at the time I did not have the ridiculous Adonis svelte body that I have today. My son is laughing hearing this. So then she calls me some fat pig and then looks at my son. And my son still to today has long hair. So at the time he was much younger. and starts like kind of, you know, what a, you call this a boy with this his hair, he's like a girly girl and so on. So I said to her, ma'am, you genuinely are a human pig. And that's where it ended. So the why am I telling you this whole story? Because the person who was going to hire me at this major university, forgive me, it's not, I'm not trying to be arrogant here. It's my colorful way of speaking. It's the Gad way. My 44-page academic CV was no longer at play. What really concerned her is that I had used the words human pig. And that is hurtful. That concerned her. So it's only when I explained the context and then explained to her that it was actually a compliment to call her human pig, because she was a lot worse than that, because she had done all the littering. She had been very insulting. She had fat shamed me. She had insulted my very young son. And so to call her human pig was the least of the worries. But look at the reflex. What might determine whether I get this full professorship at a major university in California was, why did I use such mean language like human pig? That's hurtful. So that's story two. Let's go on to story three. An administrator at my university stopped following me on social media because the person thought that I used language that was very hurtful. I said, oh, can you give me an example of the language that hurt you so much? She said, well, you will often use the word imbecile in describing some general story or something. And I don't think a professor should ever use the word imbecile. Okay? Now, why am I telling you these stories? Because again, it shows that the ethos in academia is, more than anything, is let's play nice. Let's be nice to our students, first and foremost. Now, by the way, this doesn't mean that I'm not nice to my students. I've won teaching awards, right? It's not that, I'm not suggesting you should be mean, you should be rude, you should be impolite. But my main job as a professor, when you come into my class, is to train you how to think. If you submit something that's below par, I'll give you that feedback. I won't say, you're okay, I'm okay, let's hug it out. I don't mind failing students. I tell students when they come into my course, don't ever come to me to negotiate a grade. When I go to see my physician and he gives me my cholesterol score, I don't say, come on, let's negotiate a better cholesterol score. My cholesterol score is my cholesterol score. I want to improve it. There are steps I can take to try to improve it. I don't negotiate for a better score. By the same token, I'll give you your grade down to 2 decimal points. If I've made a mistake, I'm happy to listen. Otherwise, get out of my office. But that's mean. That's so not nice. That's so mean. And then students start saying, don't take GAT science course because everybody doesn't get an A. All right, let me mention one last thing and I'll end it for today. I posted a tweet. Oh, hold on a second. I got a message here from someone. Someone from X just sent me a message. I don't know who it is. Anyways. Oh, I don't have the tweet anymore. Ugh. I posted a tweet a few days ago, which was retweeted by Elon Musk, and it got something like 32, 33 million views. And I posted several other tweets subsequent to that, which I think collectively it's probably now up to about 70 million. And there I was talking about suicidal empathy, how the misfiring of empathy as an emotion causes many of the problems that we see in the West today. Now, I had posted this a few days ago, and I ended up getting the executive editor of one of the major publishers write to me and say, there is your next book. And I suppose that 60 million views later, maybe he's right. And so now, why am I mentioning this? Because it speaks to what I've been talking about so far, right? Empathy, kindness, compassion. Don't be mean to the Guatemalan and Honduran immigrants. They also deserve a better life. Therefore, let them in. Empathy wins. Don't be mean to the bank robbers and to the guys who already have 23 arrests. If you punish them harshly, then you're double punishing them, because society has already punished them by virtue of them becoming criminals, and now you're double punishing them. Therefore, they have the rights. So, criminal greater than victim. Illegal migrant greater than veteran who served the country. You come in. By the way, here's a little story for you. 2 months ago, I went to the Steamboat Institute, which is a amazing think tank out of, well, Steamboat, Colorado. And I was speaking on, you know, American values, Western values, how global Jew hatred is growing and what we can do about it, and so on and so forth. One of the other speakers was the former Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. Why am I saying this? It's because, you know, here's a Canadian professor who has studied in the U.S., who's been a professor at 3 universities in the U.S. I've been a professor at Dartmouth College, at Cornell University, and at UC Irvine. I'm going to speak with Mike Pompeo at a conference in support of Western values. Guess what the border security did? They had to really rough me up. They had to, I don't mean rough me up physically, but they took me aside. I almost missed my plane. They gave me the third degree. Because, you know, why not? But had I come in as an MS-13 gang member with a rap sheet the size of New York, then I would have been let in as a noble migrant, and I would have been given pocket money and an iPhone and a hotel and so on and so forth. So the Canadian professor who's going to speak at a major event with the former Secretary of State is going to be harshly treated at the border, but we let in millions of people because empathy and compassion. And so my next book, and by the way, all of that empathy has its roots in academia, where it's I'm okay, you're okay. All this to say, it's very, very frustrating because, my son just wrote to me, I'm going to go outside. Did you have fun, son?
Yes.
All right.
Thank you. Bye-bye, everyone.
All right. He's had enough of my blabbing. He's going outside to play. Which, by the way, is another chapter in the happiness book, Life as a Playground. Play is not just reserved for children. Play is, what we're doing right now is play. It's intellectual play, right? Science is the highest form of play. It's puzzle. It's making puzzles, right? Which variable correlates or causes the other variable? So anyway, so all this to say, what we should be doing in academia when we're choosing academics is not just choosing people who are smart, who are educated. It's, you know how when you go to you become a Navy SEAL, there is a set of attributes. You have to be brave. You can't be cowardly. You have to be physically fit. So it's not a uni variable that determines whether you enter the Navy. As in most things in life, it's multifactorial. There are several attributes on which we need to judge you before we decide, yes, you're worthy of being called a Navy SEAL. In academia, no. You don't have to be an intellectual Navy SEAL. As a matter of fact, as I've explained, we frown upon the one who is an academic Navy SEAL. If you speak directly, if you speak the truth, if you don't mince words, again, very professorial. You know, I'm hardly not professorial, but I don't mince my words for careerist purposes. Now, the good news is the greater world appreciates that. I wouldn't have built the size of platform that I have if real people didn't appreciate that. That's why I always say I get a lot more pleasure and I feel a lot more proud when a trucker writes to me, a corrections officer writes to me, a police officer writes to me. A soldier writes to me and says, hey, guess what? I went for a jog today. I was on my truck route from Topeka to to Kansas. And I was listening to your stuff religiously. Thank you. That to me says my voice is resonating with real people. The problem is that most academics live in a make-believe ivory tower. And by the way, this is not... being an academic is in my DNA. It's coded in my DNA. So it's not as though I don't, you know, love academia. But I want academia to meet its true potential. I want academia to go back to being solely concerned about intellectual pursuits, about defending the truth, about seeking the truth. I don't want academia to be a place for kindergartens. I don't want academia to be a place for coddling. I don't want academia to be a place to play nice. Academia is not to be empathetic. It's not to elevate the voices of the marginalized people. Academia is there to elevate your cerebral hedonism, right? In the same way that you can take drugs to elevate your hedonic state, academia is the highest form of higher order cognitive pursuits. It's beautiful. There's nothing more beautiful than the cerebral life. And so all that I do is in order to make sure that we return to that reality where academics can speak freely, where academics are not being harassed, fired, threatened, have a million, frivolous complaints filed against them, and on and on. I'll be talking about some of this stuff next week at Cornell. Wish me luck as I go into arguably, and I say this as someone who adores Cornell, in that I, you know, you can't imagine. I did my MS, my Master's of Science, and my PhD at Cornell. I absolutely wanted to go to Cornell. There were two schools that I really, that were my top two when I was applying for PhDs. It was Cornell and Stanford. And Cornell, you know, being the kind of the Ivy League school, Cornell, it was the place that I wanted to be. I have great love for Cornell, but I can tell you, having gone recently, actually when my doctoral supervisor retired, this was in June 2022, there is no place more woke than Ithaca. And I have, by the way, a clip that I did where I was wearing a purple wig to demonstrate my ideological fierceness, right? That's what I call hair aposomatic coloring, right? It demonstrates that you don't want to mess with me because I'm wearing, well, aposomatic coloring is, for example, what you see when, let's say, an Amazonian frog has very, very vivid colors. Well, that goes against the idea of the evolution of camouflaging, right? Because usually you would think, in a dangerous neighborhood where there are many predators, you want to be inconspicuous. So if you evolve to be very conspicuous, that means it's because you're saying, if you can see me, you better stay away. And so I use that principle precisely because I'm an evolutionist. And I argued in The Parasitic Mind that all of the endless hair coloring that you see from the super progressive woke people at Oberlin and Wellesley and Cornell and Harvard, the reason why they have red and blue hair is because they're ideologically fierce. Don't mess with my woke venom, right? And so I look forward, as I make my way to Ithaca, to see every single house, every single car, every single hall at Cornell have the following sign. Love is love. No human is illegal. Black lives mattered. Transgender people of color are facing a genocide. You know, the six people that are transgender people of color. There's a huge genocide in the United States. Millions of transgender people of color are being eradicated. So I am looking forward to it because there are some incredible people that I'll be meeting at Cornell. I'll be meeting a rabbi at Cornell, Eli Silberstein, who used to be the rabbi when I was there. He's still there with his lovely wife, Hannah Silberstein, who, by the way, was also a PhD student. I took a course with her. So I'll be having dinner with them. I'll be meeting several other professors. I don't know if they want me to mention my name, so I won't mention anybody, but some amazing professors there. Not everyone is completely lobotomized there. There are still people who believe in science and in rational thought and in logic and in common sense and in freedom of speech. So I'll be giving two talks. One talk will be on the parasitic mind. The other talk will be on Jew hatred. You know, the Jew hatred that I was told by someone at my university, the administrator, that there is no Jew hatred at your university, other than the fact that a lawsuit has been filed by Jewish professors and Jewish students about the massive Jew hatred that there is there. There is no Jew hatred. What are you talking about? There's no such thing. It doesn't exist. So, for example, when there was police in riot gear outside the university to protect Jewish students, what Jew hatred? There is no such Jew hatred. So I'll be talking about the normalization of Jew hatred that's taking place in the West. Of course, it's not only at my university, it's everywhere. It's at Cornell, it's at Columbia, it's at Harvard, it's everywhere. It's only going to get worse unless people say, we will not tolerate this kind of nonsense in our free and secular societies. That's it, people. There are many ways you could contribute to the battle. You can speak out. If you are a donor who is thinking of donating to your university, make sure that you link your money to specific outcomes at the university. Here's the thing. You are going to give $10,000 to your alma mater. If you hear that one single speaker is deplatformed, there goes my $10,000. Now, $10,000 might not be much, but when billionaire Bill Ackman says, I might take out my money from Harvard, guess what? Harvard suddenly decides, oh, let's put in a task force to study, a task force that will consist of a committee that will meet to strike a task force to study the possibility of whether there is Jew hatred on campus. But at least you've gotten their attention. So there are many, many ways you can contribute. Don't think that your voice doesn't matter. Don't think that you don't have the capacity to affect change. All of the things that you think are cliches actually are true. It starts with one small step and then you build a community. There are some people that I know that have built huge audiences. They're not famous professors. They're not politicians. They just had the courage to start speaking out, and now they've got huge audiences that listen to them. Some of them have even quit their regular jobs to then pursue this. So I'm not suggesting that everybody has the set of skills to, you know, build a huge platform, but you don't have to build a huge platform. You can just, your professor says something insane in class, challenge him or her politely. Your friend says something insane in the pub when you're chatting, challenge him or her politely. Don't just sit and say, I'm okay, you're okay, let's hug it out, because if I disagree with you, that's not nice. You know what's the nicest thing? You know what's the most empathetic thing? You know what's the kindest thing? It's to protect the truth. There is nothing more noble than to protect the truth. When you decide that you're going to walk away and allow truth to be raped because you otherwise want to be nice, you're a coward. You're a castrated invertebrate, and I don't want any part of you. So I will continue to speak out. I hope that you will support me in any way that you can. Guys, for the price of a latte, you can join my exclusive content. So it's, I think, I can't remember how much it is, maybe $6 a month. I post book recommendations. I answer Q&A there. I post extra clips with my guests there. There's all kinds of stuff, certainly more than whatever I'm charging. By the way, the $6 a month, 50% of it goes away to Apple and to all the other intermediaries. So if you're paying me $6, I actually get to see three. And then Justin Trudeau comes along and says, oh, Jew boy, way to go. Can I have 58% of that, please? Do you mind sharing 58% of that? Because I'm empathetic and I know what to do with the money that you generate. Thank you very much, Jew boy, for your money. There you have it, folks. Please contribute in any way that you can to the battle of ideas. You can make a change. Have a great day, everybody. Thank you for joining me, and I'll talk to you soon. Cheers, everybody.